I'm Liz Joyner, the Executive Director of the Village Square. On behalf of the Village Square Board of Directors and their families, I'd like to welcome you to Fears, where not everybody shares your pain. Tonight's program is the second in this year's Dinner at the Square series, Join the Asteroids Club, a project with NYU's Dr. Jonathan Haidt, creating a new approach to communicating about the civic problems that polarize and paralyze us. To say a word about the Asteroids Club, I'd like to introduce Village Square Board member Bill Maddox.
Welcome, everyone. I'm glad to see you all here again. What my job is this evening is to just set a little context for the discussion that you're about to hear, which is really a first for us, a unique setting, as you can see here, and we'll be describing that in just a minute. The Asteroid Club is an idea that came from John Haidt, as Liz mentioned, and the basic idea is this, is that if you talk to people on the left or talk to people on the right, you will soon discover that there are certain asteroids that they believe threaten our future, that are screaming towards us that we need to do something about. Now, typically at this time, if you were here last time, you'll recall that Steve Siebert stood up and did a very thorough and important discussion of graphs that looked a lot like these, dealing with our topic last time, which was income inequality and the decline of the family. This week, or this time, our discussion is all going to be about entitlement reform and the growing debt that our nation faces, as well as the issue of climate change. And the basic graph from last time works for these problems as well. If you want to talk with someone on the left about climate change, they'll tell you this is what we have in the past, this is where we are now, this is where we're going in the future. It's very scary, it's very threatening. The same, of course, happens when you have a discussion on the right about entitlement reform. And the idea behind the whole Asteroids Club that John Haidt had was, let's get people on the left and the right together, and they can compare notes and share with each other the asteroid that they think threatens our future. And hopefully out of that will come greater mutual understanding. Well, this is, I think, a great concept and one that I'm glad to participate in. But it seemed a little bit, when Liz first explained to me, it seemed a little bit like marriage counseling, where you go and you listen to what the other spouse says, and then you try to explain your point of view, and hopefully you come with some understanding. So we determined that tonight what we really need are two things on the table that will help facilitate our conversation. One is a recognition that whatever differences may separate us as liberals or conservatives, that there are some things that we have in common. And one thing that we have in common, though we may not wish to admit it, is a shared concern about sustainability. We have with us tonight a gentleman who was sitting here at my table, David Blankenhorn, a longtime friend of mine, New York City guy, who has recently joined our national board for the Village Square, does this kind of talk, this kind of work all the time. David reintroduced to me several years ago this concept of thrift, which I think is useful for us in this discussion. Thrift is all about helping young people develop a sense of self-reliance so that they will no longer be dependents. This is what we all hope for our kids, right? Is that they'll grow up and be self-reliant individuals who will show self-control when it comes to using their resources. They won't squander things that they've been given or that they earned, and that hopefully they will have a sense of the importance of giving back and making sacrifices so that they can one day invest in children of their own and can one day support aged parents, perhaps, who may need their help. Well, it's not surprising to me that this thrift cycle has that same picture that we so often associate with environmentalism, because we all know that in many ways what we're talking about tonight is really about sustainability for the future. How do we create a future in which our children and our children's children can enjoy what we have and can flourish? So sustainability is a common denominator. There are differences, obviously, between how we see these different topics. And to help us get to the bottom of some of those differences, we asked Neil Skeen. Many of you know Neil as the former editor of the St. Pete Times. But we asked Neil to come and to do something that he hasn't done in a long time, which is to tend bar here at our Fears bar. And he's going to invite some good friends up, and they're going to have a conversation. And we think that in addition to recognizing our common concern about sustainability, hopefully after a few drinks, there will be that we'll have an opportunity to have a little social lubricant that will help facilitate a conversation that might actually lead us to a place where we better understand one another and can understand each other's concern. So without further ado, I turn it over to my favorite bartender, Mr. Neil Skeen.
Who forgot to ask how to work the microphone? Well, thank you, and welcome to Fears. You've heard the story about how this came about. One of the things that Village Square stands for is focusing on facts and not perceptions and made-up things. But tonight, you'll have to use your imagination because we didn't have a bar available for our use, and we thought we would use a church instead. But it's okay, they're Episcopal. If you see the communion serving pieces, though, just think of them as shot glasses. All right, so I'm the bartender for the evening. Some of you know that I once had a career in journalism, but the way things are going in journalism these days, I thought I would try this. They're a lot alike, really. You just sort of throw a few things together in a glass and hope it comes out okay. But you can call me Coach. There is one thing I want to do. This is my bar, and I get now for the next hour, and so I get to do what I want to. But some of you also know that for about 10 years, I have coached the undergraduate mock trial team at Florida State University. And I will tell you that being a lawyer and a bartender is really helpful in teaching at Florida State University. Did anybody see the Onion piece about how they're actually going to phase out the academic program and just concentrate on football? not everybody knows. I mean, everybody knows that Florida State just won the national championship in football, right? We know that. That was good. What everybody doesn't know is that in April, Florida State University and the mock trial team, of which I'm the coach, also won the national championship against 552 teams. But no small part of that success was due to a guy who came in last January after I'd coached this team for 10 years and never made it to the national tournament. He's a wonderful lawyer. He's a former law school mock trial champion. And today is his birthday. His wife, Gwen Graham, said that, remember that name, said that she asked him how he wanted to celebrate his birthday and he wanted to come to Village Square. And so I want you all to give a happy birthday to Steve Herm, who is right over here. Okay, so we have this bar called Fears, and Bill sort of told you this idea, sort of that, you know, everybody has their fears. Half the people agree with it that it's fearful. Half the people really just couldn't care less whether it exists and the problem that entails in terms of actually accomplishing anything to do about it. So a few years ago, after the coal plant debate in our town, a friend of ours named Brian Armstrong ran for city commission against a commissioner who had supported the coal plant. And we started meeting on Wednesday nights as sort of this was important campaign strategy planning. But it was happened to be over beers. And one of the people who came to those beer nights, besides me, was Ed Moore, who is more conservative than Brian and I might be. But we had great conversations about politics. And so as we were planning this program, we decided we would sort of replicate that event. And again, using your imagination and thinking of this as a particularly high-ceilinged bar. So for people who are more conservative, one of the great concerns in our society is the national debt and the role of entitlement spending in the creation of that national debt. For people who are more liberal, perhaps the greatest concern about our children's future is the effects of global warming. Neither side can really get the other to engage in any real problem solving about that. So tonight we thought we would replicate those old discussions from Brian's campaign just have an informal discussion about all things. I assure you that we have spent far more time on the props and staging than we have on the content. In fact, I spent most of today gathering up the liquor and just a few minutes putting my notes together. I want to welcome them here one at a time. They'll come up here to the bar. And I know there's little biographies about them in the program, or at least I think there might be. So I'm not going to repeat all of that. I want to tell you a few things you don't know about them. The first one is Ed Moore. Now, you can read in the program his role in higher education. And he aspires, but besides controlling higher education among the private colleges and universities in the state, he aspires to be like his own great-grandfather, Archibald Kirkland Mason, shown here in 1835. Ed is a grandfather. One day, inevitably, he too will be a great-grandfather. But Ed is also, and I think you'll see, if you look at the next picture, you will see the future for this man in Archibald Kirkland Mason. Ed is also a licensed soccer coach in two states. Personally, you know, as a liberal person, I think it is just a sign of how overregulated we are that you have to be licensed as a soccer coach. He was a soccer referee in two states, probably because he got ran out of the first one. He's also a certified swimming referee in two states. I don't know which two states, but it's probably not the one he's in. He also likes to hunt. And if you're squeamish, have we got this picture? If you're squeamish, don't look at this picture. But you really don't want to ever suggest that Ed is a boar. But let's all say hi, Ed, to Ed Moore. Yeah, we'll leave that one up so everybody can keep looking at it. It'll be good. Have a seat, Ed. You want to come over to the bar? Come over to the bar. So what's going down, Ed?
Need a mic?
Yeah.
We're on. What'd you say? I'm sorry?
I said, what's going down?
My blood alcohol level. Pour me one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, I know you've been concerned about the national deficit for a long time. What are you thinking about that these days?
It's a depressing day. You need to change the name of the bar to Tears. Tears ought to be the
Tears. Tears. Sure, sure, sure. We'll do that.
So, very depressing day. Besides...
You want to just pour it in there. That's right.
Justin Bieber's house getting raided this morning, the national debt is the next serious crisis in America. We got problems in River City.
Brand River City.
Big problems. You know me, I do a lot of reading, I do a lot of thinking, and you look at the size of the national debt, you look at the entitlement programs and the role they play. We're on an unchartable course. We're on a course that just can't be sustained. And as you talked about being a grandfather and a great-grandfather, we're leaving a burden to people that had nothing whatsoever to do with creating that situation, and it's up to us to solve it.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
Cheers. Fears. Well, it's about time we get Brian here. Now, Brian's a lawyer.
Where's that liberal guy?
Where is he? He handles a lot of water and electric. utility cases. Yeah, the thing about Brian
he feeds them, I shoot them. So.
Yeah, Ed eats the animals, and the animals eat Brian. That's kind of what seems to be going on here. And then after he gets eaten, he will also, as you will see, feed them. But Brian was born in Queens, actually, so that explains a lot. He moved to Orlando and then moved to Tallahassee in 2000. And we'll leave that one up right next to Grandpa Archibald, I think. Yeah.
Did he say, hey, Brian, what day is it? Huh? Oh, what day?
Well, you know, Brian has a beer bottle collection. And the only requirement to get into the beer bottle collection is that Brian has to drink the beer himself. So that's his. So let's all say hi, Brian. So
yeah, pull a table over. Pull a table over, yeah.
Let's get this out here. Get out there.
Pull a chair over.
Okay.
Gonna grab another one, or we got enough? Grab another one. That way the working folks here have a place to sit, too.
Yeah, you gotta do it yourself in this bar. So Brian, how's it going?
Poor.
Poor. I'm really sorry to hear that.
No. Poor.
Oh, poor. 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 I got it.
Need a rim shot or something.
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing I thought I'd do, Ed, is and Brian both. I mean, tell me about how you two sort of people on opposite ends of the spectrum kind of got to be friends.
Quotas. It's a quota thing. I have to have so many liberal or conservative friends, so it works out this way. Yeah.
Do you know how boring life would be if every friend you had, you agreed about everything with? Well, Ed and I are great friends. We don't agree about very much.
Other than FSU football.
And we encourage everybody. Actually, when I hold this to my hand and I think about the bar we're in Fears, I'm thinking about often that many of us have kids. And I remember my children, and especially when they got to be younger teenagers, we go to a bar and they often said, I talk too loud. And the whole bar can hear you. Well, I want to make sure everybody understands that tonight we want the whole bar to hear me, and we want you to participate. So if you have something to say, make a squirrely face or raise your hand, and let's get you involved in this conversation, because we really want to have a discussion with you all and have you participate. And you heard about fact-checking. Did everybody hear about fact-checking? Well, if you have a fact you want checked or you want to raise your hand and say something that's incorrect, let us know, because I'll tell you about the first fact-check of the night. If you open your program, you'll open and you'll see on about the third or fourth page it says City Commissioner Brian Armstrong. It didn't happen.
Use your imagination.
Yes, exactly. And as we've talked about, and we really did talk about this during the campaign, even though Brian DeLoge and others were actually on the other side of the fence from me when we got involved talking about climate change back during that election. If you remember, Tallahassee was considering building a plant together with Jacksonville Electric Authority.
Hold on. Can everybody hear Brian well? Or does he need to? Okay,
I'll
good.
Bring it right
this,
up.
This is a
I
bar full of deaf people.
Okay. But we're here tonight. I'm here to talk about human-driven climate change, and it's something that Ed and I are totally different ends of the spectrum on. And it's really a concern for me, because just like back then and what I saw going on, what I thought was going on back then, I think is happening now. But if we look at the facts, in 2004, there were 1,000 scientific studies that were analyzed, and they were by scientists. And it was, the question ultimately was, look at these scientific studies, and are they saying that there is climate change, and are they saying there's human-driven climate change? 75% of those studies said, yes, there is human-driven climate change. 25% of the studies either said, we don't have an opinion, or we don't believe, we're skeptical about it. In 2009, another study occurred with another 1,000 scientific studies that were reviewed, and the number, 97% of scientists believe there's human-driven climate change. Just recently, we had a study that involved the review of 12,000 scientific papers. 97% of the papers that dealt with climate change. Out of that 12,000, 4,000 dealt with climate change. 97% said, yes, there is human-driven climate change. Now, if you go a step further and you look behind those papers, because we probably know a lot of those are co-authored. There's more than one author. They're peer-reviewed, and people sign on. If you go the next step, it's not 97%. It's 98.4% of 10,000 scientists that said, yes, there is human-driven climate change. That's pretty incredible. Now let's think, 98.4, take that from 100, that's 1.6%. That 1.6 doesn't say no, we're skeptical there isn't. Many of them just have no opinion. And others have said they're skeptical about whether there's climate change. Think about those facts. And then think about this. Just recently, in September, a poll was done, the results came out recently, where they polled all of us. And they went to the public and they said, do you believe there is climate change? And do you know the number for 2013 is 63% of the people polled said we believe there's climate change? And a more startling fact to me is that when the next question was asked, do you believe that humans are contributing to climate change, it was only 49% of the people. 49% of the people, given the facts that we just talked about, 10,000 scientists who did studies, 98.4% have said there is human-driven climate change, but yet the public believes 49, only 49% of that believes that, 51% don't even think humans are contributing to climate change. And, you know, tonight, I guess that's one of the things we want to talk a little bit about. And as you can see, look at my man here, getting a little bit antsy. But we really want discussion among all of us about that.
No, I'm just happy that science isn't run as a democracy. Scientific change, anybody that studied scientific theory or the theory of science knows that progress comes from those outliers, the people that disagree and disprove what science believes. There are no facts in science. It's just changing reality, and I'm more in that group. If science never changed, I bet if we went back in time, 100% of medical doctors thought leeches were what you needed to cure you. Progress comes from those who challenge the accepted norm, and that, you know, you said it's fact. I don't believe it's fact. It's debatable. We'll move forward. All sides agree that we ought to do something about the environment. All sides agree that population is an issue. There's, you know, soon, by 2050, we'll probably have 9 million people on this planet. To me, a more critical issue than what the temperature is will be how are we going to feed and provide water resources for all of those people. The resources of the country ought to be focused on those kinds of issues more than let's wait and see and what scientists think now. There's 14, you can Google climate change and you'll find 14 different positions in the first 14 listings that come up. So we probably at some point ought to bring up some experts rather than us two opinionated folks.
Before we do that, let me say this. And I agree, there are people who have adverse opinions. Less than 1.6% of the scientists that we know of have adverse opinions. And this is one thing that Ed and I have spoken about. There are only a few of the high-focused people who have denied climate change. There's a fellow I'll talk a little bit about later who wrote a book in 2001 and said it's a hoax, you know, it's a farce. We waste all our money on that. And so there are some deniers out there. But what is amazing to me over the last 10 years and certainly the last 6 years is that, you know, a lot of the high-focused deniers, original deniers or skeptical scientists have now flipped. They've now turned around, and a couple of the most cited and quoted, the deniers, the skeptics who were put on TV and the radio, they have come out. One of them did a study funded by one of the Koch brothers, and he was the preeminent skeptical human-driven climate change scientist.
They changed their position?
And he did. He changed the position.
So
do you know what he said?
They can come and run for governor in Florida then, I guess.
Do you know what he said? And Ed and Neil know everywhere I go. Doesn't everybody bring a crib sheet when they go to a bar? They take it out and everything? I do that all the time, everywhere, every bar I go to. But here's the quote when this fellow went back. And what he did was he went and he looked at he analyzed all the studies that were done. The things that he doubted, and he said, I have reasons to doubt, he went and he looked at it himself with 12 other scientists. And here's the opening of his New York Times op-ed when he flipped and said, I'm no longer a denier. He said, call me a converted skeptic. 3 years ago, I identified problems in previous climate studies that, in my mind, threw doubt on the very existence of global warming. Last year, following an intensive research effort involving a dozen scientists, I concluded that global warming was real and that prior estimates of the rate of warming were correct. I'm going to take a step further. Humans are almost entirely the cause.
Hey, Coach, does he get a 10-point penalty for bringing AIDS to the
show? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's right. But I'll tell you what, you know, I think that this just proves what I always say. Every bar needs an economist. Think about that. And so I know, Ed, you've got an economist friend that you're going to bring along here. I don't know if that's like an aide or not, but I know that economics has been called the dismal science. Now, I know a lot of other science, and it sounds pretty dismal, too, including some of the stuff Brian just talked about. But we invited each of our two friends tonight to bring a wingman. Brian brought a wingwoman. But tonight, Randy Holcomb, who's an economics professor at Florida State, he writes economic analysis for the James Madison Institute. Randy and I were once, this is Randy, he's not the guy in the tie. Even though he looks like the economist, the guy in the tie is an Iranian. Randy says he wore the tie the whole time, I guess so he could sort of look like an economist. But Randy and I were on a panel one time, and I was the guy who was there supposed to talk about tax increases, and it was at James Madison, and nobody else in the room believed in tax increases. And I remarked that here I was talking about taxes and tax increases in a room of people who don't believe in gun control. So Randy, I think, was the only one who laughed. But Randy's the only one who left. So we want to show you some other pictures of Randy. But he's here. As you can see, now he's in full dress uniform as an economist. He's gone over to this Soviet country called Georgia, not the one just up the road, to teach them that central planning is not the best way to go into the future, and I guess they probably already have realized that. But he went over there to teach, and so this is Randy showing his equestrian skills. We'll show you some more pictures of Randy. He's a photographer, but he hasn't quite mastered the concept of the selfie yet. But we'll bring him up here anyway, Randy Holcomb. So.
No, I think that's the same tie. Gosh, it's a little early, isn't it? Script.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you, you wanted a drink. It's a little early for a drink?
No, not so too early for a drink. Too early for stupid questions.
Oh, yeah, it is kind of early for stupid questions.
That's all that's on my script. I don't know what else I'm supposed to say.
Yeah, no, that's his total script for the evening. This feels like the Jackie Gleason show, vaguely. We'll have Crazy Guggenheim coming up here in a minute. So, Randy, you've listened to this little discussion about from these guys. What do you think?
Yeah, I have to agree with Ed about some of the looming problems with regard to entitlement programs. And I think the facts are well enough known. I don't think it's controversial that we're spending more and more on these entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those are the big ones. We have other means-tested entitlement programs. And they're driving the budget deficit, and those problems are going to get worse. Part of it is, well, you look at the name, entitlement program. People think they're entitled to their government check. When you look at Social Security, the fastest growing part of Social Security is disability benefits. These are people under age 62 who don't qualify for old age benefits, but even though it seems like we have a healthier population, more and more people are getting disability benefits. That's one of the things driving Social Security. On the healthcare side, it's even worse, and we have demographics working against us on Medicare and Social Security. Population is living longer. There are more older people, fewer young people who are paying the taxes to support them. So these are problems. And ultimately, another problem is the interest on the debt. Right now, the interest on the federal debt's below 5% of federal government spending. But you know interest rates are very low. It would be easy to imagine when you think about interest rates today that they could triple because they've been three times as high or more in the past. And if that happens, interest spending will rise to about 15% of federal government spending. That's another 10% of federal government spending that's not going to these other programs. And in that case, what, are we going to cut the other programs? We haven't in the past. We have these interest groups who lobby to keep their entitlements. When Social Security was started, the elderly in the United States tended to be pretty poor. Today, they're wealthier than average. And yet, the AARP is a pretty strong lobby to keep those benefits flowing. And what the heck? Because when the problem really arises, they'll be dead. You know, it's somebody else's problem. So the theme here, we're talking about asteroids. So is this really an asteroid? It's a little bit different from the climate change issue. Because if you're thinking about climate change, and you're thinking this is something that's going to happen unless we do something about it. But the debt issue, that's different. When we look at the growth in expenditures, you look at what we've promised people, there's no way we can pay off what we've promised people. So this idea about, you know, entitlements growing to 50% of GDP, and eventually the government budget being 100% of GDP, you know that can't happen, right? And if it can't happen, it won't happen. So what's going to bring an end to it? And one of the problems that we have is there are all these interest groups who are lobbying to keep the benefits, and it's possible this thing just keeps going until we end up having a crisis. So how is it going to end? One scenario, look at the Roman Empire. A lot of what we see in the United States has a parallel in what we saw in Rome. They had increasing entitlement programs. They gave free bread to poor people, eventually free bread to everybody. Bread in circuses, providing these welfare programs and entertainment. And as they did, a lot of it they financed by debasing the currency. Started with Emperor Nehru. They had gold-based currency, backed by precious metals. And over time, they gradually lowered the precious metal content of the currency so that over a period of about 250 years, from 50 AD to about 300 AD, the value of the Roman currency fell to only 5% of what it was 250 years before. So as incredible as that sounds, when the Federal Reserve was established in 1913, you look at the century since the Federal Reserve was established, our currency, our dollar, has fallen in value by more than that. What you can buy with a dollar today, you could have bought with a nickel in 1913. So we're already seeing some of that. So what's going to happen? What's this asteroid going to happen? Well, I mean, part of it could just be a gradual decline like the Roman Empire. On the other hand, look what happened when people were dissatisfied behind the Iron Curtain in East Germany and the other Iron Curtain countries. And there was a sudden upheaval, a sudden change. That's the potential for the asteroid. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but a lot of times nobody predicted, in the mid-80s, nobody predicted that. Sometimes social change happens very rapidly.
You know, Neil, if I could, and Randy, we've spoken about this, and we do agree to a significant extent there are some mathematical equations here, and we can make some mathematical changes. But, you know, as I've mentioned, Ed and I have talked about it a little bit, is the solution, and what I am most concerned about is the solution, is to actually take what we may call entitlements away from the people who, in a large part, are the least able to afford to have them taken away. And is that going to make us better or worse off? What happens to those people? But it's very funny you bring up the Roman Empire, because I know, Ed, we've talked about this a bunch, too, the Roman Empire. I see the Roman Empire, and they say income inequality killed the Roman Empire.
Nuts.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I see the French Empire, and I see income inequality and let them eat cake, and that attitude killed a lot of people lost their heads because of that. They let that go too far. And isn't that something, too, that needs to be addressed together with, isn't it all part of that same mathematical equation?
Well, a lot of the benefits, a lot of these entitlement programs, they're benefits that are going to people who don't need it, people who are not poor and who are not struggling. You know, a lot of that's for the Social Security. A lot of Social Security payments are like that. But the real problem, if you look at entitlement spending, is in the health care, Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare. That's where a lot of the problem is. And my view is the problem is that because of our government policies, health care is not market driven. There are no market checks. Nobody pays for their own health care. You know, if we had auto insurance the same way that we have health insurance, you know, our auto insurance would pay for our gasoline and pay for our tires and so forth. You know, insurance should be for unexpected events. And we need to have more of a market in healthcare. Right now, it pays the companies that provide healthcare to provide the most expensive care possible because they get reimbursed. But if there was a market and people shopped around for their healthcare, then people would be competing based on price.
But what about that? You mentioned that a lot of the entitlements are going to people who don't need them or fraudulently use them or whatever. I mean, has that been quantified? I mean, that's something I'd like. I look at these scientific studies about human-driven climate change, and I know that's been quantified, analyzed to the T. Are there places where I can go? Because I looked after we spoke the first time, and I don't see any place where that's been quantified about how much is actually fraudulent or going to people who don't need it. That's certainly not what I hear or believe at this point, but I'd be willing to take a look if you can point to those.
Well, and I wish I had some good figures to tell you right now, but I didn't bring my notes. Like,
trip sheet. You should go to bars with me more often. You know I have a trip sheet every time I go to a bar.
And of course,
got a few.
But it's hard to uncover fraud. I mean, you want figures on fraudulent activity, but it's hard to uncover because people keep it secret.
You know, all right, I want to get one more person in here. I want to get somebody to help Brian out on the climate change side. All I have to do is find my notes. And being total contrarians, we have saved the woman for last. I know I'm not even going to do jokes about that, especially with all you drunks looking to get a fight. Okay, what I'd like to say about Susan Glickman is that, first of all, this was her Christmas tree. This is it. You see it?
I brought my Christmas tree.
This is the Crown Royal Christmas tree. On the other hand, I do want to tell you that she attended an all-girl Catholic school starting in the seventh grade at the Academy of Holy Names. I don't think Crown Royal was one of them.
That's where I learned to drink.
That's where you learned to drink. She decided to attend the University of Texas. Great school. Why? Because Austin has great music in Austin. And you might not suspect this, but she was also a tutor for the athletic department. She told me that she saw the Tampa Bay Bucks win the Super Bowl in 2003. She saw the Tampa Bay Lightning win the Stanley Cup in 2004.
That's right.
But I know that you did not see the Florida State mock trial team win the national championship in 2013.
And I would have been riveted.
You would have been riveted. It was riveting.
There, yes.
She's also got a sideline right now. She is working with a partner who is here.
Yes, my friend Noel Thomas, right there.
To commercialize software to track human traffickers.
That's right. That's what we do for fun.
This is what she does for fun. So anyway, here's Susan Glickman.
Great.
So Susan.
I've had a very tough day in the Capitol, and you promised me a drink.
So you want a drink?
So I can get back there and pour a little drink if you want.
So you can do that.
But you got to limit me to one. Or
to one?
Make that 1:30.
1:30. Okay, it's going to cut you off at 1:30.
So anyway.
All yours.
I think it's probably appropriate that I'm going to make a drink while we're talking about global climate change. So I've done public interest work my whole life, and I think some of it comes from those values that you learn going to parochial schools. I went to Episcopal school and Catholic school. I read the Old Testament, the Holy Communion service in 4th, 5th, and 6th grade. So when I have spent my whole life doing public interest work, and I've done tobacco policy and work on women's reproductive health issues, and I got into the public health issues, which brought me to energy and climate about 14 years ago. So on that note, we are going to have a drink because there's some pretty serious issues. So I appreciate everybody's... Yeah, that would be really awesome. Very good. So this is the Crown Princess, and that was a picture of me at the Bucks game. And as people walked down the side of the parking lot, I would say that we were doing pro bono work for Crown Royal this holiday season, and we hoped they would support Crown Royal. It was a very good cause. So anyway, people, no one knew what to do with that. So I'm going to come join.
Okay,
I met Brian Armstrong because I got involved in fighting that coal-fired power plant in 2007. Do you want me right over here, or am I going to block you?
Any chair you want.
Okay, great. Anyway, I was part of a number of people fighting about 7 coal-fired power plant proposals, and coal-fired power plants are the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions, and we have a problem. So a lot of people say to me, you know, I don't believe in global warming. And I said, believe in global warming. What you believe in is you believe in the virgin birth or you don't. That's a tenet of faith. Global warming fundamentally is parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. It's a measurement. And like your height and your weight, it just is. So this arguing about whether you believe in that or you don't is just really not valid. Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm a very practical person. And as I said, I've done tobacco policy. I'm a political person. And frankly, this is a political issue. But when I look at a scientific issue, I look at people, and I'm very much hoping that my friend Pam McVitie, who is a biologist with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, comes by tonight because she may want to add a few facts. But nonetheless, when I look at the National Academy of Sciences and the American Geophysical Union and the American Chemical Society and some 18 prominent U.S. scientific organizations and almost 200 internationally that agree, and Brian, you made some really great points, and the fact is there's not one single peer-reviewed scientific publication that flies in the fundamental face of the basic premise that greenhouse gas emissions are building up and it's warming the planet and it is human activity with the first British Industrial Revolution and then the American Industrial Revolution that has added these greenhouse gas emissions, and it's not a good thing. Now, given that we already said I work on global warming and human trafficking, my friend Noel and I call ourselves the buzzkill team. We can really put a poll on a party. But let me tell you, the good news is that we have solutions. And those solutions are the things that are going to give that next generation. And this is how we're going to solve the entitlement problem, because we're going to create a clean energy economy that are actually going to create some real jobs in this country. And we can insulate and put in new windows and be more efficient. And you know what, Randy? I loved what you said earlier about the competition for insurance, and that fundamentally our healthcare system rewards the most expensive insurance. Well, that's what we do in the state of Florida. 75% of our state is represented by investor-owned utilities. And they're like waiters in a restaurant that had a guaranteed tip on their account. Their job is to sell the extra bottle of wine and the dessert because they make more money the more they spend.
Want another drink?
Yeah, well, I haven't even started this. So that's with that, I'll hand it back to you. But we have a fundamental restructuring of utility regulation.
We need to change the name of the bar to Fantasyland here.
Fantasyland. Okay. Well, we have a lot of bar names. Maybe I should start writing them on the board here. So let me just ask a question. So how much of this, you know, that guy Bill who was here earlier, he's gone now, right? He sort of showed that chart, you know, past, present, and future. It's kind of like the ghost of Christmas past, present, future. And it's sort of the lines going up, it starts going up. And I thought he was going to climb up a ladder, you know, and show us the very tip top of that, like Al Gore did. But that's the line that both of you talked about. I mean, we've talked about it for entitlements. The line sort of goes, and, you know, as the baby boomers get older, as the number of people who are producing earned income and FICA withholding and Medicare withholding gets smaller, that gets to be more of a problem. You, Susan, and Brian have talked about parts per million and the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and what it does to the Earth's temperature. And that number starts going up, and the more it gets, it's kind of like the boiling water. You know, I mean, everything in it starts to get really hot really fast, and it goes up really fast. So to what extent do we think that each other's hockey stick chart is real, or is it in fact, is the problem with the numbers, the scope of the problem to begin with, or is it what we do about it, if anything? Ed, you were going to say
yeah,
something.
Yeah, I'll go first on that one. I think of the two issues, the most solvable and most critical, immediately critical one, is the issue of spending. If you want to solve all of these problems, address any kind of environmental concern, you don't have the money to do it based on current federal budget. How do we get here? In my view, and I guess this is where liberals and conservatives have a big divide. Back in 1964, when President Johnson announced the war on poverty, his intent then was to eradicate poverty, to do away with it, to remove poverty from the United States. Instead, what we've done is built up a total of 80 federal programs that are means-tested programs, none of which ever go away, none of which ever are evaluated for effectiveness, and they continue to be fed. As they are fed, they grow. Randy mentioned on the federal budget size, right? Right now, entitlement spending is about three-quarters of the federal budget. A quarter of the federal budget goes to defense and operations, environmental concerns. Everything else the government does comes out of one quarter of the federal budget. So when they talk about cutting the federal budget, it's almost impossible to do unless you address that three-quarter number that is huge. We have failed. The war on poverty, we lost, and it's time to acknowledge that. It has taken people out of poverty. The situation in the world back in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s was vastly different than it is now. There have been effective programs in place, but we never take a look at them to see if it could be done better. They grow like kudzu on the highway. They just keep growing and growing and growing, and we never trim them, we never change them, we never do any program evaluation. If we want to address all these other kinds of issues, we better get a handle on federal spending.
Well, I'll come back to talk a little bit about entitlement spending later, but I wanted to sort of jump on or correct a point that you talked about, the idea that we don't have enough money to fix these environmental problems. That's really not the issue with moving to a clean energy economy, because we're already spending money. We talked about coal-fired power plants. There's also been an effort to build four new nuclear reactors. Duke Energy just canceled two of them. And in 2006, when they passed a very special law to allow for cost recovery for new nuclear power plants in advance of building the power plants, it used to be you couldn't charge someone until the plant came online, but they gave them this very special provision, and they started collecting money. And the plants at the time, they said they would be $5 or $6 billion, and now they're $25 billion, because again, they are the waiters in the restaurant, because they make four times as much money with a new nuclear power plant, although not one has been built in 30 years, and they're probably not going to happen in the state. In fact, Duke has canceled those. But the point is what it's about doing the most economic thing first. It's about doing conservation. It's about saving money. And when you put a solar panel up, and I know my friends here, Marty Monroe and John Rimes, are very happy solar owners. John may want to chime in about what a great payoff they have had in the solar. So people are financing in themselves, but then they have solar energy for free for many years. So it's not an economic. It is a complete myth to say that somehow clean energy costs more. It is not true.
Tell that to the people in West Virginia.
Randy.
Can I throw in something there?
West Virginia.
Because I think at least the way so far we've framed this climate change issue, it's especially the way both of you presented it initially, it's the believers in climate change and the non-believers. But I don't think that's quite right. I mean, I think there are a lot of people where the big issue is, what should we do about this looking ahead? In order to get a handle on that, let me start by looking back and let you think about this a little bit. Because all this addition of the carbon to the atmosphere is a result of the industrialization that goes back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Look at all the heads. Everybody says, yeah, that's absolutely right. So let me ask you people, I mean, now we've created this problem. How many of you would be willing to go back to the same standard of living people had in 1750 in exchange for removing that carbon out of the atmosphere? Back in 1750...
That's not your choice.
Back in 1750, 85% of the workforce was working in agriculture, because that's how many people it took. You know, it's the hand labor walking behind the plows. If you go back to 1900, look at the 20th century, the per capita income in the United States went up by seven times from 1900 to 2000. So if we just look at the carbon we've added to the atmosphere from 1900 to 2000, how many of you people would be willing to cut your income to one-seventh what it is today in order to not have that carbon in the atmosphere now?
Randy,
so
that's not a choice
back
either.
So now let's look forward. If we're actually concerned about the well-being of people in the future, we need to make sure, as Ed was saying, we need to make sure that we maintain the economic growth so we can improve their welfare. Over the past century, our per capita income went up by seven times. If we keep economic growth going, per capita income can go up another seven times. So how do you think people in the future would be better off if we keep our current standard of living and reduce global warming, or If the Earth warms by a couple of degrees and people have seven times as much income to deal with it. So now I'm not suggesting that Susan or Brian are talking about no economic growth. What I'm saying is we need to look very carefully at the costs that we're talking about when we're looking at climate change. And because of technological advances, it may be that the best thing to do is to wait on some of these things. Because technology advances, it could be cheaper in 10, 20, 30 years to address these problems than it is today.
Randy, and I guess I'd like to address that. You very skillfully changed the approach that Susan and I have, and that is...
Thank you.
I don't want it very skillfully. My hat's off to you. But I got to tell you, I'm not saying non-believers versus believers in climate change. I'm saying non-believers versus believers in 10,000 scientists, 98.4% of whom have studied the issue and said there is human-driven climate change and it has to be addressed fast. And another point I'm saying is some of those deniers or the skeptics in the beginning, I talked about one of them. There are a number of those skeptics that now have flipped and done their own analysis, and they've said, yes, it is happening. Yes, we must do it now. Yes, it is significant. Yes, it is an asteroid. There isn't one scientist that has flipped and gone the other way and said, well, I believe that there is human-driven climate change. I changed my mind. I'm a skeptic now. Not one. So I don't want to. What I'd love to see is that at least we recognize the facts that the science is pretty much sealed, signed, and delivered. You know, especially when I know there's one skeptic left who continues to get depressed, and you've probably heard his name. It's Lindzen, and he's the same scientist. He is a physicist, but he's the same scientist who, for years and even to today, has not ever agreed that smoking will cause adverse impacts on the health. And he's the same fellow who's holdout for whether or not there's human-driven climate change. I take 98.4% of scientists over a fellow like that at this point, no hands down. And I would just like the public to know that. So the public doesn't have to make a decision, is there or isn't there. Let's listen to the folks who are the physicists, who are the real folks who have studied this, and let's make our decision based on that. But let's make sure. One of the big problems, just like the coal plant back years ago, I had a real problem, which was a spin. If you remember how many, here we were trying to get out facts, and we were dealing with multi-hundred-thousand-dollar budgets that were doing all over the newspapers and the radio and everywhere. Everything was, the coal plant is necessary now. The coal plant is going to be clean coal. No such thing as clean coal. This wasn't then, isn't now. Do we all know what happened when JEA was not able to build that coal plant years ago? And it's something that we said they would do. The people in Jacksonville had said, we don't want any more coal plants. We have two of them, not a third. That's why they came over here to begin with. It was out of sight, out of mind, so they built it, wanted to build it in Perry. And we said, hey, if those people in Jacksonville don't want it, we shouldn't bring it over in our backyard. Well, when it finally got shot down, they built a natural gas plant in Jacksonville, in their backyard. They reduced their emissions by 50% because they're using natural gas, which is 50% less carbon dioxide. They reduced their rates. Do you remember how we heard we need the coal plant? The rates are going to go up. Rates are going to go up. What happened to your rates here in Tallahassee? And do our county commissioners get any credit for the fact that many of them did acknowledge that it was a mistake that they were going to coal?
I'm going to add to that, Brian.
The rates have come down here. They've gone down in Jacksonville.
Well, let me ask a question here. To what extent do we have to all agree on either of these, the scope of either of these problems, or even the causation of either of these problems, to agree on any steps that might be taken on either front? Susan talked about the people who turn to solar voluntarily, for example. They act to some extent on their belief and their sense of civic responsibility. To what extent can we also do that as a matter of policy
on
entitlements as well?
Okay, it works.
Well, part of what happened...
Mic check at the bar.
Part of what happened in the coal battle, and my friend Steve Urs is back here.
Who was that person?
Involved in this. The city of Tallahassee said they needed 210 megawatts going over the next 20 years. And they ended up in what you call an integrated resource planning. It's a utility planning process where you put supply and demand on a level playing field. And they found they could meet 165 megawatts of that 210 with energy efficiency. Energy efficiency and conservation is the cheapest stuff there is. Why on God's green earth, when you can get energy efficiency for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 cents a kilowatt hour, would you go build a coal plant or new nuclear plants that are, you know, 15 to 20 cents a kilowatt hour? So that's what the city did, and you all have a very, Gil Ziffer sitting here, others, you have a very successful energy efficiency program, and the city's utility has very high ratings, but that's what we need to do all over the state. And municipal electric companies like in Lakeland, Jacksonville, Tallahassee, Orlando, they operate with a different motive. And so I think this is where we need to come to terms with the politics of this. I about fell off my chair during the 2012 Republican convention when Mitt Romney in one of the debates said, "I love coal." Well, I did events at both conventions, and let me tell you, the Republican convention was sponsored by the coal companies. And he said, it was almost reminded me of like a product placement. Does anyone remember the movie Wayne's World, where they made fun of product placement? So Mitt Romney actually stood up in a national debate and said, "I love coal." And all countries like, and I know you alluded to West Virginia, and I'm sorry about the people of West Virginia, but we cannot be buggy whip people. We do not go out and buy 8-track cassette decks. And if anyone in here has an iPhone, like many people do, and other, you know, wonderful telephones, think about that for a minute. Should we be stuck buying rotary phones just because people in West Virginia? There's going to be a whole new set of jobs that's going to come out of the clean energy economy.
Like Solyndra.
Neil, I just want to point out here that we've talked a lot about the coal plant and electricity generation in Florida and so forth, but if we're really concerned about climate change, there's not very much we can do at the state level. Florida
that's
produces very little in the way of greenhouse gases. The real problems are over in China. They're overseas in other areas. And in fact, if we raise the cost of energy in the United States, we push more production overseas to where they're even dirtier. Now, China's cleaner than the United States?
No, we're not going to raise the cost of energy. And here, let me just do the Solyndra thing because I don't get it. The reason Solyndra went out of business was because the price of solar went down. That's what happened. Their business model failed. And if you know how to get rid of sweetheart deals where campaign contributors get special deals, let's figure that out. That might be a whole other Village Square. But that's not what Solyndra was about. China flooded the market with solar and the price came down. That's what happened to Solyndra. And it's not about energy costing more.
Hey. Yeah, that's great. If China will flood our market with lower cost solar panels, we don't need a public policy for that. Individuals themselves will choose the cheaper option. That's the way that we ought to approach it.
But we don't have competition. That's the problem.
But let's suppose, I mean, is there a, should there, what if there were a state policy that said, as I think happened 3 or 4 years ago, we don't want any more coal plants in the state of Florida. And suppose that we have the situation that Brian described in which building the natural gas plant actually ended up being a cheaper alternative, I think, in terms of consumers, as he was describing it, than the one that was in mind, although it was a good, I mean, it was one reason, was diversification of sources and so on. Suppose it doesn't cost that much different. Suppose it's more efficient for everybody to build natural gas than for one homeowner after another to do solar. I mean, how do we think about this in terms of choice versus a general public policy? Let me look at Randy and then Ed and.
If you're talking about the market for electricity, which we've talked about a lot, that's a regulated market where the government has given individual companies monopolies. So the problem there is largely a problem of government policy. When you give somebody a monopoly and you guarantee them a rate of return. So the issue there isn't a problem with the market, it's a problem with government policy. But so often I think the problems we have are problems of government policy. And the problem there, I don't see how to get around it, is it's driven by politics, not by economics or good sense.
Here, here. I totally agree.
So I guess we can leave it.
Yeah. Okay, so we're all
good to hear an agreement there. But
can I offer you a Crown Royal?
And there are, I got to tell you, there's one thing that whenever I've heard Solyndra very often, Ed and I talk often, like you know, and there's one thing I do every time I hear him raise the name Solyndra, and that's I take out my handy bottle. I tell them, because I hear it's I hear it so often, Ed. You know that. Yeah. But anyway, you know, there are things we can't
like
do on a policy
level.
Federal
government imposed policy, and I don't.
There are things we can't do as a policy matter. I mean, in California, we don't want to hold ourselves up to California too much. They have their own problems. But that's one of the places where electricity use has gone down. And electric utility use per capita has stayed down. And one of the main things they do is they incentivize the utilities. The utilities can make more money by implementing efficiencies and achieving those efficiency gains than they can by building new plants, spending money on new plant. If that went around the country, you're going to see a nice impact. You're going to see a nice impact on electric rates going down, and utilities will have their profits. The other thing that I want to, and I know this is a hot button item, but it's something that really has to be discussed as well. And I don't like playing with the words. I don't like the spinning. You know, it's a carbon tax. And it's been called, a carbon fee and dividend in the past to try and get away from the word tax, because we're also afraid of tax because we know certain elements are going to come out and say tax, 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 hard, horrible, horrible, horrible. But if we tax carbon at the place, if it's coal, where it's taken from the ground, natural gas, where it's taken from the ground, whatever, but tax it when it's first taken out of the earth, and then have that distributed to the public, and make sure that that tax goes up over time.
Audience question, which I have a lot of, related to that. Wouldn't a carbon tax provide a market-based solution to global climate change?
I'm sorry, say the first part again.
Wouldn't a carbon tax provide a market-based solution to global climate change?
I'd say yes. I'd say absolutely. And I hate the word, the fact that we get off on this word tax and say it's horrible because it's called tax. But the point of that, too, is it's a tax of it that the studies have been done. It's easily collected because you're collecting it at the place it's taken from the earth. But the dividend part of it is that, look, the money you're collecting goes back to the public. So if the utility is paying a tax, it's going to get passed through in rates. But then the public would get the benefit of those dollars. And I would hope that some of that money goes into investment in further research and further, and I'd like to get into that at some point, other technologies that would be available to us potentially.
Anybody else on that?
Go. Yeah. I'll let Randy speak to the market part of that. But I'm always baffled. I'm sitting here looking at Allison in the back of the room and smiling. Liberal response always seems to have the word tax included in it. You're going to solve stuff by taxing people more, taking money out of the pockets of those who would make a better decision on their own, and give it to government to have an imposed program by government. It doesn't work. If I go back to what I was saying before on the war on poverty, which is should be half, we're going to end up spending the whole time we have up here talking about climate change. But we don't have the money. And the federal government is outspending the means available to it. They're putting future generations in debt. And if the only solution to this problem or any other problem is to impose another tax on the marketplace, it will not work. It will become just like any other government tax and government program.
But that, you, both of you guys, it's an unfair mischaracterization that this is a tax, because we're paying for
it. He just called it a tax.
I understand he did, and I want to disagree with Brian on that, because it is not a tax. We are paying for it right now. Emitters are polluting for free, and we are all paying for it. And it was C. Boyden Gray, who was an advisor to George Herbert Walker Bush, who came up with the original cap and trade concept, and that was on the acid rain program. And it was an incredibly highly successful program that dealt with acid rain at a much lower cost than they thought it would. So the environmental community in 2009 and 10 embraced this concept of cap and trade because it puts a price on carbon. I wouldn't call it a tax. I put a value on carbon. Put a price on carbon, because we're paying for it now anyway, whether we like it or not. So I disagree with Brian's mischaracterization of a tax, and I disagree with what you said. But it is not fair that the world and all of us are paying for Tampa Electric Company and Duke Energy and others to pollute. That's what we need to fix.
But let me just interrupt. I want to go back. You got another question on the climate issue, not entitlements. I want to come back to
this. This is actually to Randy. What are the costs of climate change?
That's a good question that I don't think we know the answer to. I mean, we hear about Miami's going to be underwater and so forth, but maybe we can have wheat farms in Siberia that's now covered with ice. If you go back before about 1980, if you look at the scientific literature on climate change, the big concern on climate change was the coming ice age. And the most frequently cited article out of Newsweek magazine, I don't know that they're now out of business, don't know that they were necessarily proud of it. There was a 1976 article in Newsweek on the coming ice age. And so the climate science changed a bit on that. But when they talked about the coming ice age, they talked about the ice caps moving down and we're losing fertile land, you know, the wheat growing land and so forth. But just the opposite happens if we do have climate change and it warms up in the north. If I was living in Russia or Finland or Canada, I would welcome a little bit more warmer climate. It lengthens growing seasons. We can grow more food. So there may be some advantages. But I wouldn't stake my argument on that. I mean, what I would say is we want to be careful about policies like a carbon tax that will slow economic growth, because if we look into the future, we're trying to take care of people in the future, maybe they'll be worse off if we have a warmer climate. Maybe the people in Montreal will be better off. But slower economic growth is going to make everybody worse off. And you look over the long haul, like I said, over the 20th century, per capita income grew by 7 times. Wouldn't you like that for your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren to be 7 times wealthier than we are today? So we need to be careful not to impose costs on the productive part of the economy that's going to stop that economic growth, or even slow it.
Randy, if I could, you know, it's really interesting. And that, and I'm sorry, I brought another piece because I had it in my pocket here, but it's an article, and it talks about
the rules were no visual aids.
It talks about 5 skeptics who have changed their position and now are acknowledgers of climate change. And it's interesting you talk about Russia, because the president of Russia was one of those skeptics before. Actually, what he said earlier, back in 2009, was climate change is some kind of tricky campaign made up by some commercial structures to promote their business projects. But do you know what he said after Russia has gone through some terrible situations with horrible events, physical, natural events? Now he said, unfortunately, what is happening now in our central regions is evidence of this global climate change, because we have never in our history faced such weather conditions in the past. Well, now, climate change is not today, tomorrow, yesterday. Climate change is over eons.
Right. We heard that in Florida. I mean, when we had those 2 years, 2004, 2005, with the 7 hurricanes crossing the state, and we saw climate change is causing this increase in hurricanes. So we heard the same thing in Florida.
Hang on a second. Susan wants to use a lifeline.
I do. So, among us is Pam McVitie, who is a biologist at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, and I see her squirming, and I think she might really want to respond to Randy's last diatribe.
You gotta have a microphone.
You come on up. See, I just think you guys are missing the point. We send about $60 billion out of the state of Florida every year to buy fuel. And if we would really take significant, and the reason that California's energy consumption has remained flat for 30 years is their loading order promotes all cost-effective energy efficiency that costs less than new generation. So if we adopted that policy, we'd keep those energy dollars and we'd help our economy. I don't know why do you guys act like it's going to hurt the economy. But go ahead, Pam.
Well, I'm really good at squirming, and Susan's better at answering these questions than I am. But we already know quite a bit, not enough, about what the costs of climate change are going to be. I just read today an article said that because of the flooding that we experienced with Katrina, Wilma, Rita, and now Sandy, that FEMA's flood insurance program's going into debt. They've never been in debt until 2005, and the debt is going up in the neighborhood of $30 billion. So that's one point I was squirming about. The second point I was squirming about was that if it gets too hot to grow crops farther south, we'll just move north. That's nonsense. The soils aren't the same. The light conditions aren't the same. The seasons aren't the same. there's a reason why crops grow so well in the Midwest. And it's because they have the right soils, the right light, and the right seasons there. So those were my two most recent squirms.
What about, I'm going to go ahead and ask this while you're here, Pam, too, and anybody can answer it. What about the argument that global warming is a fact, and it's been warming for over 10,000 years, well before human activity could have created a significant effect? How do you reconcile that with the argument that of human origin? Anyone?
Well, Pam, if you want to, I mean, either. Go ahead.
Well, the way I'd answer it is that we've known since the 1700s and the 1800s that carbon holds heat, carbon dioxide holds heat in the atmosphere. But the actual warming that we've seen that's so extreme has been occurring since the Industrial Revolution. If there was warming before, it was associated with being in an interglacial period. And those glacial periods that we have were caused by a tilt in the Earth's orbit, I believe, or the Earth's axis was a tilt. And so, yes, we were warming, but it wasn't related to the warming that we're now experiencing, which is the direct result of increased greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which hold heat.
Hang on one second, because they can't hear you.
And there have been studies that have shown there's been a CO2 cycle, and the Earth actually has mechanisms that will remove the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And, you know, the Earth's been here for 5 billion years, been through a number of temperature cycles. And my geology friend's saying that there's nothing that's going to stop it unless a supervolcano or a meteor or something like this. And that the Earth has been without an ice cap before, and we're heading that way sooner than you think.
Actually, yeah. We're going to let you guys go home, and we're just going to continue the conversation here.
I'm not the expert. I'm sure there are people in this room that know more than I do about this. But CO2 levels have never been as high as they are now. If you look back 600,000 years, 700,000 years, they've never been like they've been now. And what's significant about that is when they were higher before that period, and they were, man did not live on this planet. The planet was not the same planet that we live on. It's not the same planet that all of the history of mankind has occurred during. And that, as far as I'm concerned, that's the planet I want to live on, not what occurred before the dinosaurs and before humans were on this Earth.
You know, it's interesting, and I just want to go back to that carbon tax for a second, because this is something I know, using that word tax is horrible. You heard Susan doesn't like the word, and, you know, you heard my buddy Ed's reaction to the word. But, you know, it's not something. What it is addressing what Susan's problem is and my problem is and Pam's, I'm sure other people. The use of coal is hurting us all right now, and it's going to hurt us more. And it's going to hurt the next generation, the generation even worse, if we're not doing something actively. And, you know, I look at Florida Power & Light here that serves, you know, the biggest in Florida, and they serve 4 million customers. And they did start to slip and go back a little bit towards coal a few years ago at the time when it was stopped. No more coal plants. They lost. They didn't get it. But they've done a lot of things with nuclear and other things and natural gas now in a very big way. They wouldn't pay as much in the carbon tax if because of their supply. They don't create the carbon emissions, they'll pay less. Customers of Florida Power & Light will pay less. Revenue generated, again, if we can work it out with revenue generated can come back to the adults, every adult, every child in the United States. I don't see that. That's not hurting anybody. That's helping, because the impacts, the negative impacts, Randy, that you want to know about, they're huge and they're happening. Anecdotally, you talk to your friends like I do, who go down and they go down to the Keys and they snorkel every year. And they come back and they say, they're not necessarily saying it's climate change. They know that's what I believe. But they say it's happening. The coral reefs are dying. The seas are acidified, and they're dying. Every time I go back there, there's more dead. And that gets them concerned, thank God. It should have all of us concerned, and that's really my point. You know, we have to acknowledge it. You know, I blame a lot of this on, just like I did the coal plant, the press, and this predilection now to say there are two arguments, and they treat them equally, like the same. I mean, how many times have you heard that out of 10,000 scientists, 98.4% believe in human-driven climate change? How many times have you heard that? The press should say that all the time. And they should say, and the denier over here, the skeptic, give us a little background on that, you know, that fellow or those fellas.
It's just the right-wing media. But I'd just like to ask Randy, one of the problems, and this is sort of the last, I want to sort of wrap up on climate and come back to the question of budget and spending and entitlements.
And get to the audience for questions.
And we've got some questions. One of the problems, it seems to me, is, and economists have a term for it that I can't bring to my mind now, but it's basically the problem of the stuff that is free.
Externalities,
but it's sort of the free. The air is free, so we all just pollute it because we pay no price for that. This seems to be part of this debate, whether we, you know, to what extent we attribute man-made or not man-made, anything else, to what extent we do anything about it. Partly is what is our approach to having people take responsibility for these seemingly free things that others of us bear the cost for.
Yeah, and I am not a climate skeptic or denying climate change. The question is, what should we do about it? And you don't have to be a skeptic or a denier to say we really don't know 50 or 100 years out what the effects are going to be. But the question is, what are we going to do about it? A lot of what Brian and Susan have talked about have been policies here in the state of Florida. But it's a global issue, and we're not going to solve the problem with Florida policies. I think largely I agree with you on the Florida policies. So I don't think we really have much of a disagreement there. And there's a problem that there's not a market. It's a regulated monopoly. So I don't think we have that much of a disagreement on the Florida policies. But if this is really an issue, the problem is in China, the problem is in India, the problem is in Indonesia, the problem is in other parts of the world. And we're doing a pretty good job of controlling our carbon emissions compared to China, compared to Indonesia, compared to India, compared to other places in the world. So I feel like both of you have been harping on this problem but haven't even really touched on a feasible solution, because the solution isn't a state of Florida policy or even a U.S. policy.
I think we might have an agreement there then, and let's see if we do. I mean, you're acknowledging that the use of India and China and the continued use of coal and expanded use of coal is causing a climate change problem and is causing a significant harmful effect on not only them but us. I mean, are you acknowledging that?
We have a question over here.
That could be, but then you ask yourself, what's the best way to deal with things that other people are doing? And one way to think, I'm not saying this is the right answer, but a possible answer is we'll be better off if we have pro-growth policies in the United States, which will raise our standard of living, which will better enable us to cope with any climate change that occurs.
Fair enough, Randy, and I love the fact that we're able at least to get to that point, because, you know, a lot of people are trying to deny that. You know?
Okay, I want to turn now to come back to the budgetary question.
Can we ask a question?
I'm sorry.
Right here?
Good, okay, that's great.
I had a question about I've seen that number of 10,000 scientists thrown around a lot by other people. This is not original with me, but some people have questioned whether 10,000 scientists might not include a lot of political scientists and social scientists, not real scientific people who don't have any more better opinion than I do about whether there's global climate change going on or not. And I would guess that most of these people are from an academic background, affiliated with a university of some type. And I'm also guessing that a lot of these people are like a lot of my friends who are university type. For the most part, they toe the line and they espouse the line that's politically correct for them to agree to. And there's probably two reasons they do that, summed up in two words: tenure and grants.
Sir, it's great you raised that question. It really is. And I can tell you one thing, and that has been raised, you know, grants, what you ended with. Let's talk about that. I mean, people who have been acknowledging climate change for years, for over a decade, they've gotten less grants. They've gotten hurt by going out there and sticking their neck out there and saying this is what's happening. When I talk about these deniers who have now flipped and said, yes, we acknowledge human, they have gone through all the studies, all the data. They're the ones who went through 12,000 studies, determined that 4,000 of them talked about climate change. They're the ones who went and said, okay, let's add up how many scientists authored this. I can't look, and there's at least a half dozen that I could talk about that have done that by reevaluating, going through the data themselves. I read you the quote. The biggest skeptic before had 12 scientists working with him. funded by the Koch brothers, or one of the Koch brothers at least, and he went and they reevaluated the data, and they came out, and to the credit of the Koch brother, whoever that was, but they released that data, and they said, I have now looked at it, I was skeptical, I'm no longer skeptical, human-driven climate change is happening. Not only that, we need to address it fast, it's going to hurt us, our children, and our grandchildren. So it's valid points, and I understand you. That's the state we're in this country right now, is everybody's skeptic about where it's coming from, but that's why I ask you to think about the skeptics who have now reevaluated and gone through the information. They know it's scientists.
Let me do this. I need to switch. Ed, you've got a fact check.
Yeah, I do. I want to hear Randy's response on that first.
Yeah, that is a great comment. I'm not a climate scientist. I'm an economist. I'm also a tenured faculty member at Florida State University in the economics department. And I think your point is right on about the way that research takes place, that if you're looking to get publications that build your prestige, you're more likely to find acceptance for your work if it agrees with the conventional wisdom, and that's also especially true about grants, that when you apply for grants and they're refereed by other scientists, and if 99.9% of those scientists believe in the climate change, they look a lot more favorably upon your grant application. And it's not political, but it's a matter of they read that and they say, yes, I think this is right. We should fund this, as opposed to saying, no, this is crazy. We're not funding this. This is going up the wrong alley. So the academic culture I see in economics, I don't know about climate science, but in economics, you're exactly on the mark as far as the incentives and the way that scientists get behind the conventional wisdom on an issue.
Okay, I don't want to talk about that anymore.
It's boring.
Ed, do your fact check.
Your tip is going to go down, you know. So.
I know. Yeah, I was, somebody else will double it, maybe.
Okay, I've got a fact check here. Somebody handed a statement that you believe may be factually wrong. The current administration is responsible for the current debt. Your alternative view, I'm trying to read the writing here. I've heard that the previous administration was on watch when the debt went from approximately $4 billion to approximately $10 billion. Is this accurate? If so, is that more than the increase during the current administration? I'll speak to this real quickly. Note that in my reference to the entitlement spending and the increase in national debt, I'll go back to Lyndon Johnson with the war on poverty and what's happened since then. We've had 5 Republican presidents since then and 4 Democrat presidents, and a pox on all their houses. None of them has addressed the growth in spending accurately. None of them have taken the time, and part of it is just the nature. Probably I studied too much of this in my undergrad and doctoral programs. Presidents aren't in there long enough to grab hold of big problems. I mean, it's rare for any of them to really grab hold of a big problem. They tend to reorganize, and when they reorganize, the beneficiaries of that are the whoever succeeds them. What needs to be done, and all of them need to whoever is in the White House needs to take a look at these spending programs and find out which of them work. We have spent about $22 trillion on those 80 programs I mentioned earlier. The 80 means test programs provided by the federal government, we have spent about $22 trillion since Lyndon Johnson on those programs. The rise in people that are below the poverty level has gone it's up about 31% since 2008. It's growing. It's getting worse. We're not getting better at what we do. We're getting worse. The data on here on the fact check, $4 billion roughly to $10 billion, I think it was around $9 billion when George Bush left office, and we're at $17 billion now. So the increase is exponentially bigger, and George Bush was exponentially bigger than any prior presidents. Probably, the economists here, if you added up the debt from all the previous presidents, it doesn't equal what's occurred during these last two administrations. We have big problems, and there is a reluctance to address these problems in Washington.
Well, let me ask this question.
That's politics.
Yeah, and it is politics, I think, but because I have a tweet here from a man stuck on the George Washington Bridge in Fort Lee.
Speaking of politics.
Who says a pox on all your houses, too? but basically says, what about defense? I mean, to what extent is this a question of which category you attribute the deficit to? You know, that everything else is fine, and now let's talk about entitlements.
Whose ox is being gored?
Whose ox is being gored?
If you go back to 1960, before the war on poverty, more than half of the federal budget was national defense. Fast forward to today, it's less than 20%. So as a percentage of federal spending, defense has fallen a lot, and there's not that much more room to cut. But I think there is room to cut. I mean, this is a little far afield from what we're talking about, but goodness, we got our military forces spread all over the world, and I think we could cut in defense too. But that's not really where the deficit problem is. It's in the entitlement programs. And it's a bipartisan effort. I mean, President Reagan, when he was elected, said he'd balance the budget and left with a huge deficit. And conversely, when President Clinton left office, we had a budget surplus. So I don't think it's one party or another. I think both of them are trying to spend us into bankruptcy.
I've got a question.
Yeah.
I want to ask each of you guys to forget for a minute that you live in Florida, and I want you to pretend for a minute that Social Security does not exist, okay? And then I want to ask you, can any of you imagine on your 65th birthday sitting down at a table and writing a letter to your kids that says this: "Dear kids, even though I am able-bodied and able to continue to support myself, I'm tired and would like from now on for you to send me a check each month that I can live on." Would any of you do that? And if you wouldn't do that, because I can't imagine a father or mother worth it, his or her salt doing that, why do we ask the Social Security system to, in effect, do that for us? And if the answer to some of this old age entitlement problem is the fact that we need to perhaps look at raising the age so that it goes to a point where we really are no longer able-bodied, should we in Florida ask ourselves whether what could be good for the country might be bad for us, since our economy does depend, or benefit at least, a lot on the dependent elderly?
The problem is that we're bound to that company store. 40 years ago, I would have withdrawn from the Social Security program and not paid into it and not expected anything. I would do that today. But under our current system, that's not allowed. So we all then become dependent on a Social Security system that is unsustainable.
Yeah, good answer.
So I want to mention something. So in the 90s, I had the pleasure of spending a day with our then U.S. Senator Bob Graham, as he used to allow people to do this sort of shadow program. And he would take you to every meeting you went to, and one of the meetings was with Warren Rudman and Paul Simon, and the subject was entitlement spending. And this was, I don't know, I couldn't even tell you what year it was. Maybe it was 1994 or something like that. So I happened to see said Senator Graham on Saturday at the Everglades Coalition, and I said, "Whatever happened to that?" And he said, "Susan, it is all about politics." So this is where I think global climate change and all the related issues, what we do to deal with the problem, and where entitlement spending connects. And that's because at some point, someone's going to have to make some tough decisions. And I think you actually laid out some of those. And I think if you add the moral question about whether or not we're going to saddle the next generation with paying for people who don't need help, or saddle the next generation with paying with this buildup of greenhouse gas emissions that's going to cause sea level rise. And you all are up here in Tallahassee, which is this, I am going to start my 27th legislative session. And I actually went to school here a couple years. So I've spent a lot of time in this town. But go down to South Florida, where I just was with 800 people at the South Florida Climate Compact, and they're looking at sea level rise, or the FAU Sea Level Rise Summit. Let me tell you, I barely can sleep at night when you look at this. We are in line for 3 feet of sea level rise. Pinellas County's doing a climate vulnerability assessment. They've done this already down in South Florida. I mean, it's... And I love you guys, and I want to go drinking with you where you guys are actually also drinking. But Well, you guys you're sort of.
She's back talking about climate again. You know.
Yeah, no. Well, I'm talking about the similarity between the two issues, and we cannot saddle the next generation without looking at those very important issues. And fortunately, and what Senator Graham said was, until you get the Republicans and the Democrats willing to work together and to not throw firebombs at each other, you are never going to have a solution because everyone's going to be afraid of how it translates in an election.
Because Bill asked all of us to respond, and I've been biting my cheek here, but you know,
the guy keeps showing up here. I don't know who this guy is.
It's a good question, and it's based on a hypothetical, but I don't like to deal with hypotheticals that have no basis in fact, and so I won't deal with it that way, but I will say this. We forget, when we look at Social Security now, I'd like to remember the fact that Social Security has been such a huge boon to the middle class and to the people of the United States and to so many millions and millions, and to the fact that now we have 50% of our elderly now that are relying upon Social Security? Is it more than that now for 90% of their income?
Yeah, but it's a Ponzi scheme, okay, so the people in early always get a good deal.
Okay, and that's I'm not going to call it a Ponzi scheme or anything, but we can't forget that that's the facts. You know, if we want to talk facts and policy, all right, let's look at the facts first and look at how many people are so reliant upon it. Now, those people, Social Security, we paid into it. Ed says he would have chosen if he had the choice not to pay into it. But the fact is we all did, and there was a reason we paid into it. And you know what? The reason worked. To a huge extent, it worked. Now, we will agree, and we've talked about this mathematically. There are mathematical things that can be done. We have to share the pain. You know, I'm at the cusp now where I'm looking at 54 years old, and they keep talking about 55 and up is not touched, and 55 down. Let's hope it takes another year for this to happen, I guess. But you know, where do you draw that line? It's nonsensical to try and draw that line, but I guess we'll have to, and we'll all have to pay something. But I tell you, when I listen to this, let's entitlements, and then I listen to the tax thing, and it's reduced taxes, you know, whether it's the wealthy or otherwise, reduced taxes on the corporations, reduce. And I always hear repeatedly, reduce the taxes on corporations, they'll hire people. Where is the study on that? I'd like to see the studies on that, too. And, you know, it's never there, but that's all you hear. I hate the spin, and I want to see facts. I want to see studies. Ed doesn't like scientific studies to the point that it's not that he doesn't like them, but he thinks they're always subject to challenge.
I love the studies. That's how change comes about, is through study.
We're going to run out of time, and I do want to not have people feel like they're under a mandate to stay here. And I know that at least two of you would agree with that. But I want to ask one more question, and then I want each of you to take about 30 or 45 seconds and just sort of give a few final thoughts. But I wanted to go back to Bill's question. I'm going to assume if we means-tested Social Security that it would not be to the benefit of most of you on the panel. Would you agree, not having opted out of Social Security, are you prepared to give that up as part of bringing down entitlements, spending? Ed.
I'll go first on that one. No.
And, okay, that was good. Direct answer.
Because, in fact, I have started working at, 14 or so, so I've been paying into that system for all this time. Whether I should, because of the longevity of age and the actuarials on that, when they started that program, at least 4 years, probably 6 years longer life expectancy, people are living longer, people are collecting longer, perhaps that's a way to look at this, where it gets spread out over time. Congress, that's one time on a program that they actually have made some modifications on it, where they pushed up the ages trying to induce people to work longer, and people are working longer. Sometimes they're working longer because the economy stinks, and they have to, but you can prolong until 65, 67, 70. At some point, I think it's 71 and a half. You have to start collecting on that program. It's not something that you just fix by taking away. There again, the solution is always tax more, go more to the wealthy. There's not enough there to fund that program moving forward. You're going to have to make significant changes in that, either in the younger people moving into it and giving them other options, or seriously altering the program over time.
Let's go down. Susan was the last one in, so in good accounting, we'll have last in, last out. Randy, we'll start at your end. A few concluding thought here.
Yeah, that's a good question that you asked about Social Security, and I don't think it's my choice as to whether I'm means-tested out of the program, but what I will observe is that the AARP and other lobbying groups are going to stand in the way of that until maybe it just becomes inevitable. But both Brian and Ed said that they paid into the system all their working lives, but that's not really exactly true because it's been a pay-as-you-go system. So you were paying in order to pay the benefits of the people who were recipients at that time. So there's the money that you paid in, that's already gone. So it's not a matter of I paid in, I deserve to get my money back. Your money's already been spent. That's one of the problems with the program. But when you look at entitlements, the big problem really isn't Social Security. It's Medicare and Medicaid. That's where the big spending is coming, and that's where we need major reform.
Brian?
This is the housekeeping. This is the wrap-up?
Wrap-up.
Okay. Just two housekeeping items. Number one, this is definitely water. I just want to... That's not vodka, so please.
I got vodka.
Yeah.
Well, so what's your excuse then for right. what you've been saying?
That wasn't very nice. My second point is this. I've listened to Susan talk about, and she let it go real quickly there, but her point is her belief in human-made climate change is as strong as her belief and faith in the Virgin Mary, or in the virgin birth. So I never wanted to lose that belief, so I brought her a little memento. It's a little statue of the Virgin Mary that I want to always to keep that belief strong. Okay. My other point, though, is you know, and obviously I'm focusing. Actually, Ed and I agree to a large extent about some of the entitlement issues, but I think it's a broader picture. And if you're going to deal with entitlements, you have to deal with taxes. You have to deal with. You should be dealing with it all. And nobody should be escaping some of the pain. I'll pay some of my pain. Everybody should pay some of their pain. Some people can't afford because they don't have a penny to pay, you know, and we have to recognize that. That's always been the case, and it's not going to change. But on climate change, you know, have I said it enough? Human-made climate change, and the fact that I look at a study that says 49% of people believe that humans aren't responsible for it or don't have even the – they're not predominantly responsible for it.
Those were Romney voters.
And 60 – see, I'm going to have another drink now. And 63% of the people at this point in time are saying they don't even believe it exists. I mean, we got to change that. I mean, 63% believe, you know, believe it exists, but yeah, 37% of the people who are thinking it doesn't even exist. We have to change that. I want to commit to help try and change that. You know, there are a number of folks. Susan has been doing it for years and years. Steve Urs and others at PAM, and there are ways to change it. There are policies. We haven't been able to talk about a bunch of them, but let's keep our eyes and ears open. 10,000 scientists, 98.4% say human-made climate change is happening.
Yeah, we've got to speed the wrap a little bit. We're over.
Ed?
Wrap.
Yeah. Last word.
I think I did it.
Oh, okay.
I started. Okay. So I have one last confession. So I'm transpartisan, and that means I sort of hate both political parties equally, because we need to be in a framework where we're about solutions. And there were things that everybody tonight said that had merit. And I think if we relook at a system, and I think age is different. You know, when we moved into the 21st century, and they did the Time Person of the Century, and they named Jeff Bezos from Amazon. They hadn't even made money yet. I was like, let's talk penicillin for a minute, right? We used to die at 45, right? So, I mean, the world is a different place. I already, you know, talked about the cell phone, my gosh. So we need to look at this differently. We need to look at how we are going to figure this out. I mean, when, you know, Social Security was it about little old ladies not eating cat food or choosing between their pills. I mean, let's just get real and figure out what that is. But no one's capable of doing that anymore, in part because there aren't very many Warren Redman and Bob grams in the system, because they're all about firebombing, and we saw that when we shut down the government. I mean, you know, what does that look like? What do we look like internationally when we do that? We look like toddlers. We look like idiots to the rest of the world. So we've got to have a clean sheet of paper and look at new solutions. You know, Silicon Valley is loading up with lobbyists. Lisa Jackson's now at Apple, because our laws don't even make sense for where we are technology-wise. I mean, it just, we're like, have you heard about these 3D printers? They can, like, print a gun, right? I mean, I don't even get it. But anyway, we need a new thinking. We need to be forward thinking. We need to throw away the partisan. Fully 25% of the electorate has no party affiliation in the state of Florida. People do not affiliate with the political parties. And let me tell you, I really needed a drink when I came in here, because I spend all this time in that Capitol. And it is not about what's right or wrong. It is not about good policy. It is about how much money people give. to both political parties and all the politicians and their funds. And anyway, if we don't get money out of these decisions, and that affects entitlement spending, I think this is an area we'd agree.
You're moving into a whole other panel.
Yeah, we'll bring you back. Just a final thought here, and we'll wrap. Thank you all, first of all, for being here for this. I hope part of our idea is that people who don't see these asteroids quite the same way have a chance, should actually sort of undertake the effort to listen to what the other side says. I often find myself thinking two things. One is, how do I know what I think? How do I know what I think is true? And the other is, what if I'm wrong? What would I do if the other side is right? And it's a very interesting exercise as you listen to people who are thinking about and trying to wrestle with a lot of these issues. We thought that the last thing we would do is that instead of being abstract, people with positions, and we don't know, that we would essentially humanize the enemy by bringing them together here tonight, showing you their pictures of Grandfather Archibald and people like that. And it's also a great way to think about the people who are next to you who might disagree with you, who are nevertheless wonderful people, as all of you are. And thank you for coming.